Good afternoon. This is Pat Moore. I'm the host of KTOO-FM's Juno Afternoon today. Today I'll be talking with Della Cheney, the representative or the recipient of the Alaska Federation of Natives Culture Bearer Award this year. Dr. Elaine Schroeder will drop in to talk about grief, death, and hospice during our series on hospice. Ken Fix will be here to talk about tonight's planetarium presentation. It's on Helios and the Aurora Borealis. And teacher Sunshine Nguyen will be here with some members of the 2011 Mendenhall River Community School Marathon Club. I'll have Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, music, and a little bit more all day today, all this afternoon for an hour on KTOO's Juno Afternoon. The weather calls for mostly cloudy with a slight chance of rain and snow, highs around 40, east winds 10 miles per hour, and tomorrow looks a little bit nicer. We'll probably have a slight chance of rain in the morning.
Voice of American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Tribes on the Wind River Reservation are investigating health concerns involving uranium contamination. In 1958, the Susquehanna Western plant started producing uranium yellow cake on the Wyoming Reservation. But since the mill closed, nearly 2 million cubic yards of contaminated materials were left behind, uncapped and unlined until the late 1980s. In the second of a two-part series, Wyoming Public Radio's Tristan Autone reports.
For almost 20 years, rainfall and snowmelt drove contaminants such as uranium and vanadium from Susquehanna Western's outdoor contamination pile into the ground and ultimately into the area's water table. Since then, rumors about the area ranging from two-headed animals to high levels of cancer have trickled up to the highest levels of tribal government. Wes Martell is co-chair of the Shoshone and Arapaho Joint Business Council.
We know of some of our tribal members down there that have suffered some real serious cancers and thyroid disorders and nerve disorders and respiratory disorders and babies being born with deformities and, you know, things like that.
It's stories like these that prompted tribal officials to contact Follow Atkinton, senior epidemiologist for the Montana-Wyoming Tribal Leaders Council and acting director of the Rocky Mountain Tribal Epicenter. Atkinton has been tasked with leading an epidemiological study of the area after hearing similar stories from community members and taking a tour of the site.
By the time we went around that neighborhood, I could count how many, on one finger, how many didn't die of cancer. So practically all of them around that age group had died of cancer or have cancer right now. And that was quite alarming.
Atkinton says she's in the process of collecting scientific data over the next 2 years to prove or disprove the stories. The Department of Energy says the area is safe. However, with studies, analysis, and reports not due for up to 2 years, residents of the area will remain in the dark. For National Native News, I'm Tristan Autone.
Inuit people are adjusting to change in their communities and want to make sure they're involved in development. Akalek Ling is chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council. The council represents Inuit people in Alaska, Canada, Russia, and Greenland. Ling says his people in Greenland are facing continued interests in mining and oil development. Offshore drilling started last year, and he says they're mindful because of oil spills in the U.S.
We should be very careful on what we do in our waters, where the fish and our marine mammals that we live off, of course, are very important that we don't destroy our environment.
He says they're on the way to industrialization faster than expected, and it's bringing financial benefits, but also challenges, including issues with a boom in transportation. Ling says one of the most important things Inuit people need to do is be involved.
It's very important for Inuit Circumpolar Council as an international organization that we use the Arctic Council, where we sit together with the eight Arctic states and the six indigenous people's organizations from the Arctic, that we have a say into the dealings of the world, the global situation, you know.
Inuit people are also facing threats from climate change. Ling says Inuit people keep in close contact with Native people in the United States and learn from their dealings with governments. He addressed thousands of Alaska Native people recently in Anchorage. During this month in 1871, President Grant established the San Carlos Apache Indian Reservation in southeastern Arizona Territory. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Institutes of Health and National Cancer Institute, dedicated to improving the health of the Native American community. Learn more on how your local community can participate at www.grants.nih.gov. If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you can get free legal help with filing a claim at meetings held around the country through December. Details and a schedule of meetings is at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after 3. We're in the middle of the pledge drive, our annual pledge drive, one of our two here at KTOO, and we have folks here from the Plain Rain Artists Group and Friends of the Alaska Museum who are standing by our telephones. If you'd like to pledge, call 586-3636, and they'll be glad to help you out. My first guest on this afternoon's show is a lady who has won a very prestigious award. She is the Alaska Federation of Natives Culture Bearer, Della Cheney. Hi.
Hello.
So, Della, this award is given to an Alaska Native who demonstrates strong involvement in the arts. And the individuals nominated for this award might be involved in theater, music, dance, painting, sculpture, storytelling. You told me earlier you're a storyteller. But I think really what you're known for most is pottery, is weaving. Yes. and making baskets. You have pieces, I think, in the State Museum. I know you've done workshops over there, I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have anything in the State Museum. Most of my work is for my family or friends. May I take a minute to introduce myself?
Yes, please do.
Dathkawas Hinu Khat Kil Dikiang. My Haida name is Dathkawas. Katsawayu Khatdua Sauk. My Tlingit name is Katsawa. I'm originally from Cake, Alaska, and I just want to say Hawa Salana. For my family in Cake, Heidelberg, and Masset, British Columbia. Hello, and I'm so glad. I hope you had time to listen to us today.
Thank you. Before we started up, while we were listening to National Native News, we were talking a little bit about the fact that you're from a community where you have 19 siblings, and Cake is small enough that that's most of the town, I think. So you're really related to almost everyone there.
Yes, I am. I was born and raised in Cake, Alaska, graduated from high school, and then went on to college. And I grew up with my mother and father, my brothers and sisters, the younger siblings, and aunts and uncles, grandmas and grandpas, extended family. And I'm saying this because the majority of our older siblings, including mom and dad, were at boarding school. Mm. And so I was one of the privileged to feel the love of family and extended family. So I'm one of the privileged children that came out of the village.
Now you live in Juneau?
Yes, I live and work in Juneau, Alaska.
Do you miss Cake?
I miss Cake, more or less the family, which is Cake, like we said. But I think the living in Juneau for the past probably 35 years, intermittently, mm-hmm. as I moved along. My daughters grew up here, graduated from Juneau Douglas High School, and this is really their home, Juneau, mm-hmm. but they still visit Cake and love to travel to Masset, British Columbia also. So I think we're not only extended family, but our community is also extended across this place.
When you introduced yourself, you introduced yourself both with a Haida name and mm-hmm. a Tlingit name.
Yes.
So you touch both of those cultures. Does that ever put you in a position of confusion, or is it harmonious, or is it?
It's quite harmonious because of the place we grew up in. Mom and Dad spoke English, but they also spoke their language. We were encouraged to speak English. We listened to the different language, Tlingit and Haida, but we were encouraged to speak English because of the changes that were happening, that happened in their life and were happening as we were growing up. And my mother was a teacher she was one of the first 7 certified teachers in Alaska. I should say Alaska Native mm-hmm. certified teachers.
You're a teacher now, right?
And I'm a cultural teacher.
And you teach at one of the local elementary schools?
No, I retired from Floyd Ryan Middle School. I was the cultural educator there for 10 years mm-hmm. and then worked at Sheldon Jackson also in a similar position. And today I'm working with the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. Mm. I'm an administrative assistant to the president. CEO, Roald Helgeson, but he'll be leaving our consortium to the statewide consortium shortly. So when you mentioned, do I ever feel uncomfortable
yeah.
about being Tlingit and Haida? I don't think so, but sometimes there may be confusion if we go to a ko'ich, which is a memorial party.
Mm.
And the person is also like me, Tlingit and Haida. Then the role gets a little bit tricky. You got to figure out which one you're going to be seated as, an eagle or a raven. But other than that, I don't think there is any that I can put a finger on it anyway. So. But it also is being Tlingit and Haida, the cultural ways are quite similar. And weaving happens in both cultures. So I'm learning how to weave Tlingit, and they weave up from the bottom up, and Haida weaves down from the top down. So when you're thinking about your pattern, you have to keep that in mind, which way it's going to go. Because one time I did one pattern, the flying geese were supposed to be flying north, or was it south? And I wove it flying the other direction, but they really go both directions. I was just trying to be in control of it, and sometimes you don't have control. You know, it just happens sometimes. And weaving different patterns of our community and the environment is so much a part of our way of life that it's hard to separate for me in my mind, you know, when I harvest and process materials from the forest or the ocean or wherever. That I don't see myself as separate from that way of life, from the environment, because we're so hands-on, skin harvesting roots or harvesting cedar bark or harvesting fish or seaweed or, you know, all of those ways of life that we love. And it's hard for me to separate it out as a separate thing.
When you said that when you weave or when you make a basket, you do it from within.
Yes.
And I thought about that when I read that, and I thought, when I think of a basket, I think of it as something that I put things in.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of clothing, I think of it as something that I put on me, or someone else puts on them. But that changes the perspective. If you're weaving from the inside of if the basket is coming from the inside of you.
Yes, the creation is such an important part of weaving. When someone is thinking about creating a piece of work, whether it's a robe or a basket or a mat or whatever, the design is, you have to create it in your mind and with a good spirit. That good spirit reflects in the work you do. The beauty that comes from within is there in front of you. And the more that we can create something beautiful like a basket or a robe or a mat, it's coming from within your mind. You're thinking about it. Your spirit has to be in a good place so it comes out really nice. And the love that you have for the family member or friend that you're making it for is a big part of what you're doing, creating, because you're thinking of them, and only those wonderful thoughts. I was weaving, and now I'm weaving a robe for my oldest daughter, Gail.
Mm.
She's going to receive her doctorate's degree in leadership and change. And thinking about those words, I'm creating a robe using the geese symbol, the flying geese. You know, they fly like this in a format, sideways V.
Formation, yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Or then you'll see them change from one side or the other side. The V will change. So that leadership is constantly changing for something to get from one place to another. So that pattern is something that I created in my mind's eye to show the change and the leadership change for her robe. And the colors I'm using are red and white and black with a little bit of yellow. And the red outlines the flying geese. And you have a positive and negative when you're weaving, raven's tail weaving, because that's the way life is, right? You will work with both positive and negative things. So one side will have red with a white. The pattern is white. The next one will be a white background with red as the flying geese. Mm-hmm. So you get into it. It gets pretty intricate as you're thinking about, you know, what you're doing. And that's why I think that when you're working from within yourself to create something beautiful, you have to have that space within you to have a good spirit and bring it out so that it has a life that's going to be 100 times longer than mine will be.
Wow.
So that means that what I'm doing today will still be here long after I'm gone. So with that in mind of the work that we do, that's working from the inside out to create this space that will be here hundreds of years from today. And that's a special place that we need to create inside of us. to take care of our community that we live in, this environment, this place, this love for family and friends, that it's constantly changing, but it never really, you know, has that sharpness to it, because you're trying to keep everything in a good place and a good spirit to weave.
Della, I absolutely understand why you're now called the culture bearer. You bear the culture in your heart and your soul. Thank you so much for sharing that with us today.
Yes, well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm wishing everyone a good day.
Thank you.
This is Bird Note. The sun rising over a South Texas grassland finds a flock of sparrows, like these Cassin sparrows we're hearing, perching atop a mesquite bush. They're awaiting the sun's first warming rays. Suddenly, the sparrows flee as a dark bird of prey races toward them, flying just above the ground at breakneck speed. This time, the sparrows escape, and their pursuer, an aplomado falcon, alights to survey the landscape. It's a truly handsome bird, its plumage a bold pattern of black, white, and rust. Aplomado falcons were once widespread residents of the American Southwest, but by the 1950s, they'd disappeared entirely from the region. Loss of habitat, loss of prey, and pesticides all played a role. But in the 1980s, a group called the Peregrine Fund began breeding captive aplomado falcons. Over the next 25 years, 1,500 fledglings were set free in South Texas. At the same time, conservation pacts with private landowners provided more than 2 million acres of habitat. While work remains to ensure the bird's recovery, the handsome aplomado falcon appears to have regained a solid foothold in the American Southwest. Today's show brought to you by the Lufkin Family Foundation. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
It's 23 minutes after 3 o'clock. This is Pat Moore. I'm the host today on Juno Afternoon. We'd like to thank Greg Pilcher for calling in and pledging for our fund drive. You can call 586-3636, and Friends of the Museum and members of the Plain Rain Artists Group are standing by to take your calls, and we would just love to hear from you today. So 586-3636 to pledge your membership at KTOO, FM, KRNN, and KXLL. So my next guest and I are going to talk about a subject which is probably a little difficult to get around. Dr. Elaine Schroeder is here as part of a series that we're going to do every Tuesday during the month of November, and we're talking about hospice care and the things that come out of that, and today's topic is grief and death. Hi, Elaine.
Hi.
So how are you?
I'm great. I just took a walk on the wetlands and had lunch with a friend and my daughter, and it's, hey, it didn't rain today.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
and
very special.
It's supposed to not rain tomorrow, too.
It's supposed to be beautiful.
The forecast, they're saying, is mostly cloudy, a little chance of rain in the morning, and then highs 41, southeast winds, light and variable, and they're saying no rain in the afternoon, so it could be just a real nice day tomorrow.
Yeah.
So do you do grief counseling?
I lead the bereavement group for hospice.
Oh.
And so hospice has hired me to lead an 8-week bereavement group twice a year. I actually am in private practice, and so of course I work a lot with grief with my clientele. But what I'd like to really look at today is the bereavement group, because a lot of people wonder, do I qualify for a bereavement group? Do I need a bereavement group? But can I just give you some basics on it?
Yeah.
It's an 8-week group. It's happening right now. Tonight, actually, we'll be meeting, and it'll be our second group. So this group is closed. We have a good number of people. And I would love it if you would sign up for the next group, if anybody, not you, Pat, but if anybody listening is so inclined, just give me a call and I will send on your names to hospice. We'll be doing another group in spring. We do two a year. So if this seems appropriate for you, please call and get on the list. So it's an 8-week, I would call it psychoeducational. It's not a therapy group. And not all people who've lost a loved one need or feel like being in a bereavement group, particularly right after the death has occurred. That's not a great time to be in a bereavement group. Mm. People who are in the group say that, oh no, it would have, they were in shock. They need time to settle down, particularly if there's a memorial service and a lot of activity and a lot of things to get used to after the death. If the death was somebody who was really close to you, meaning a spouse, a daughter, a son, a parent you were taking care of. So let's just say a couple of months later would be appropriate.
Are there signs to look for that to know that you're ready?
I would say you want to do it, and it's been a couple of months.
Okay.
Well, you could say, well, do I really need a bereavement group? The American way of dying is probably not a particularly, or let's say the American way of grieving is not a particularly healthy way, because if you take a look historically and cross-culturally, other cultures and other times in our own history, we've had far more elaborate grieving rituals. And we've had far more community support. People didn't move around as much. People weren't as isolated. People lived with extended family. So there's lots of support. I lived in Asia for 6 years and witnessed both Hindu, Muslim, and Buddhist traditional funerals and grieving processes. And here I live in Southeast Alaska. And I would say Tlingit people and other Northwest Coast Indian people culturally have very meaningful and elaborate grieving rituals, some of which I've attended. And Middle America doesn't seem to have that.
Hmm.
And often there's just friendships. You don't want to burden your friends. So I would say you're never going to be hurt by going to a grief group. And the people who've gone are usually pretty enthusiastic about it.
So you used the term psychoeducational.
Okay, psychoeducational is kind of a jargony term. It means it's not a psychotherapy group. It's not a therapy group.
Okay.
So educational, I give kind of like mini lectures and information, then I have people break down into smaller groups to talk about certain topics. So if you're shy about being in a group of 8 to 12, you'll be with just one other person for part of the group, and then we'll have group discussions. So that's the format, and that's technically what you would call psychoeducational. Just so people realize, grieving and bereavement is not a mental health issue in the sense that it doesn't mean it's like childbirth doesn't mean you're sick. You go to a hospital, but it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with you. And grieving is not the same thing as depression. There's grief work that we all have to do if someone who's really close to us dies.
Mm-hmm. And some of that you have to do basically without help, and some of it you do need help for, is what you're saying.
Well, I mean, really great. I talk about the tasks of grieving, and one of them is to talk about and explore. That's what our Western minds seem to like to do. And looking at, for example, the exercise we did last week, one of the exercises we did, or when I say exercise, I mean discussion, it was, what are some previous losses that you've, serious losses, let's discuss those that you've had in your life. Because let's say your dad died when you were 7, and it was in the era where little kids didn't go to funerals, and mom put away all the photos, and it was hush-hush, and basically, you're still kind of bottled up about it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then your husband dies. Or your mother dies, or your sister dies, that may impact the current grieving. So I have people take a look at other losses in their lives, what they know, what they expect. Because one of the things that people may think is they're going crazy. So there was a book that came out a couple of years ago called The Year of Magical Thinking, and it was the story of one widow's first year after her husband died suddenly of a heart attack. And it's called magical thinking because she was pretty, she felt she was going crazy. Now, she worked. She was functional, but she felt crazy. And it's extremely supportive since a lot of widows and widowers, and this group isn't just for widows and widowers, anybody who's close to you, if you deem that's an important loss, it's an important loss. And anyways, a lot of widows and widowers will be instantly alone.
Mm-hmm.
And you can feel like you're kind of banging against the four walls. And it is a relief to talk to other people who have been there or who are going through the same thing. You feel a little crazy.
So about 2 months after?
Well, I'm just saying.
And this, I understand.
Yeah, and you
it's
know,
not
it's
a,
almost,
we're not talking 60 days exactly or something.
No. And it's almost an equation.
Okay.
Because something that, like a spouse or a child, is an extremely profound loss.
Mm-hmm.
Because it impacts, well, with a spouse, it impacts your day-to-day life. You might need a little more time before you're in the group.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if your 85-year-old mother died of natural causes, now not everybody, and when my folks died, I didn't go to a bereavement group. Guess what? Of course, they didn't have them because hospice didn't exist. Because my mom and dad died 30 years ago. But it is not something that, depending on the context of the death, it may be expected. If you have like a really good relationship with, let's say, an aging parent, and they're in their 80s or 90s and they die, and they live in Chicago, and you love them, but, I mean, most likely somebody's not going to go to a bereavement group. But let's say something a little more complex, like your parents divorced, you had little contact with your father, you had a tortuous relationship with him, and he dies at 60. Ironically, even with that distant a relation, that may be a tougher thing to grieve because you never had a chance to really connect with him.
Yeah.
Right. So it's in the eye of the beholder.
Good. So if someone feels that this is what they want, they should contact hospice or you.
Yeah, exactly. They can call hospice or me.
The next group.
And I'm in the phone book, and so is hospice.
Okay, and the next group will be sometime in the spring.
It will be.
Okay. Elaine, you do incredible work.
Oh, I love this work. Yeah. I love this work. I love working with bereavement and death and dying issues.
Well, thank you very much for coming down and talking
to
us.
Thank you. Bye.
It's 3:33, and my next guest has been here with us on several occasions and is in the middle of a series of things related to bodies in the solar system. Ken Fix, who is the guy in charge of the planetarium, I guess, would be your – is that your official title?
Well, I'm not in charge of it, but I'm sort of the director of programming.
Sort of the director. Well, let's do a little bookwork first. We're in the middle of the pledge drive right now, and it's 586-3636 if you'd like to pledge. And, Ken, who are we thanking right now?
We'd like to thank Doug and Paige Bridges in Juneau for their generous donation to KTOO.
Okay.
And anybody else that's listening in, hey, the request lines are open.
Hey, we'd love to be thanking you for your donation. So call 586-3636. The Friends of the State Museum and members of Plain Rain Artists Group are standing by to take your calls. So, Ken, you're doing a series on various things about the solar system, and this one is about Helios and the aurora.
Yes, this is the first time I've ever done a repeat. The last time I did the presentation was in May, right before the Memorial Day weekend, and with people leaving town, and plus the fact that the skies were past astronomical dark, it wasn't really the right time to do the presentation. So this is the first time I've done a repeat, but I've revised it just a little bit, but otherwise the content's pretty much the same. I think there was only a dozen people the last time I did this one, so it really shouldn't be anything but fresh for most of the people because they haven't been to it. So,
okay. Now, Helios is the Greek god of the sun.
Yes.
Okay, and there's a relationship that everybody understands, I think, now between the sun and the aurora. Have you updated your talk? Because just in the last couple of weeks, there's been some terrific solar activity.
Oh, yeah. There's some photos as far as Little Rock, Arkansas, that were taken October 24th, and they are in the presentation.
Ah.
So, yeah, I have updated those and got those in.
Just right now, we have a very active sun. There's a huge increase in sunspots.
Certainly. We're approaching the solar maximum, which the scientists are predicting should take place between January and May of 2013. So we're not even there yet, but we're getting close. But, yeah, you're seeing quite an increase in sunspot activity. You're going to find more interference to satellites in the coming months. Your GPS stuff may not work quite as well as you think it's going to. All of that is subject to interference from the solar winds and the coronal mass ejections, which would be taking place.
Yeah, and I think even as we speak right now, we have a fairly significant coronal mass ejection going on that's probably going to affect some radio conditions in the next couple of weekends. I'm a ham radio operator, and
mm-hmm.
we love it when it does that because
yeah.
it kicks up the frequencies and does some really interesting things to let you talk over long distances.
There's been auroras that have been recorded so active that back in the late 1800s, before we got into more sophisticated stuff than the telegraph, that the operators were actually able to operate the telegraph by the amount of energy that was coming through the lines. They didn't even have to apply anything to the lines to send their signals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it generates a significant amount of current at the surface of the Earth, so during a really powerful auroral event. So, and that's interesting because the aurora are literally hundreds of miles above the surface of the Earth. So we're talking about a big, major energy force here.
Certainly. Anytime we see an aurora event, it means that Earth's magnetic defenses have been overwhelmed. Our magnetic field sort of acts like a big, cushiony balloon that's around the Earth. And the weakest points, though, are actually at the poles.
Yes.
And when the coronal mass ejections arrive and that resultant energy overwhelms the magnetic field, it's like snapping rubber bands. It comes back down the field lines, generally to the poles. That's why we have the aurora borealis in the north and the aurora australis in the south.
So, Ken, if people want to catch up on the latest on the aurora, they need to be at the planetarium when?
6:30 p.m. tonight to 7:30. I believe we are going to do a brief running of the stars tonight. And I will be presenting the mythology of Helios and two of his daughters, which lets me tie in stories of Odysseus and also King Minos from the island of Crete. And I wind up getting into Icarus and Daedalus, so mm-hmm. those myths all tie in together. And then I'll begin the presentation about the sun and the aurora phenomena itself.
Wonderful. And the planetarium is located at?
We're on Glacier Highway at the Marie Drake Building, and we're just before the high school. If you get to the big fence along the side, you can't miss us. We're just past the fence where the little dome structure sits on top of the Marie Drake Building.
Okay, and it's a good idea to probably bring a cushion or something like that because you're going to be looking up at the ceiling. You might want to put something behind the back.
Well, you can. Usually what we do is the PowerPoint presentation goes onto the dome, but it's projected probably just a little bit above straight-ahead viewing height, like on an angle of about maybe 15 to 20 degrees. It's no higher than that. So nobody has to just sit there and crane their necks up and look vertically at the ceiling.
Okay, good enough. Ken, we're lucky to have a guy who can bring the stars to Juno on nights when we can't see the sky, which
well,
is
it's
most
not me. It's a team effort over there. I'm just one of several volunteers.
Okay, well, thank you very much for telling us about the upcoming show.
Thanks again, Pat.
When the light is low and the day is done, aurora dances down When she finds the land that thirsts for sun, Aurora dances down. When the stars are up and the moon is dark, Aurora dances down. When the night leaps out like a fiery spark, Aurora dances down. Oh, she'll spin and turn and chill and burn till your knees fall to the ground. She wears the starry crown when the moon and sun are joined as one. Aurora dances down. Oh, the voice will still and the heart will leap. Aurora dances down. As the midnight watch we keep, Aurora dances down. Every human burning beast, Aurora dances down. All partake of the swirling feast, Aurora dances down. She'll spin and turn and chill and burn till your knees fall to the ground. She wears the starry crown when the moon and sun are joined as one. Aurora dances down.
It's 20 minutes, well, it's 19 minutes before 4 o'clock, and you're in tune with KTOO-FM, where we're in the middle of a pledge drive right now. You can call 586-3636 to help us continue broadcasting the things that you love to hear on KTOO, and we'd like to thank Corrine Conlon for contributing this afternoon. 586-3636, the Friends of the State Museum and folks from the Plain Rain Artist Group are standing by out there. Now, in the studio with me, I have a bunch of people who have completed a marathon. That's 26 miles, 385 yards, right?
No, we did 26.2 miles.
26.2 miles. And who are these marathoners? Who are you?
I'm Michaela.
I'm Julia.
I'm Ruchi.
And I'm Connor.
And you're Connor. So you've done a marathon.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the people who do marathons are few and far between. Have you done a marathon?
I have not. Not
you
personally.
Have not done
no.
a marathon.
I
okay.
Have not.
Well, I have twice, as a matter of fact. And I can tell you right now, it's hard work, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah,
it's a lot of hard work.
Now,
yeah.
you did yours in stages, right? You did a mile a day?
Yeah.
Is that how that
yeah.
worked?
Yeah.
Okay. So where did you do your mile?
At our school.
At your school. So, now, which school is that?
NRPS Valley.
Okay. And when you run a mile, one person answered, we're getting way too many voices. So when you run a mile at that place, where do you go? Go ahead. Where's the mile course?
Talk to him about where exactly you're running.
We're running twice around the school.
Twice around the school. Okay, and that's 1 mile?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And you did that every day for 26 days. And then when did you do the 2/10? The last day?
Well, we did that on the 26th.
That was our run down the hall.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I heard about that. So both sides of the hall, everybody in the school is out on both sides of the hall, right? And they're all clapping you guys through and like that. Wasn't that something when you came across?
Yeah.
Yeah. So did you get a T-shirt or anything?
Yeah.
All right. Wait a minute.
Sweatshirt.
Hold it. Let's see this sweatshirt. Mendenhall River Marathon Club. It's got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 runners all in running position going across the front of it. Everybody's got this sweatshirt? Why didn't you wear them? Jeez, we could have got pictures of everybody in their sweatshirt in their sweatshirts. Wow.
Well, we did, and actually, it is going to be posted in the Capital City Weekly.
All right.
Tomorrow. So as of tomorrow, our picture will be in there, and a small little blurb about our marathon club because they have worked so hard. We had 108 students sign up for marathon club.
I got four of them here, but there's a whole bunch more, right?
Yeah, 96 were able to finish.
96
finished this year.
Yeah,
through the rain and everything. So it was just amazing.
So all four of you ran every day, right?
Yeah.
So you got the whole impact of this thing. Okay. So did your feet hurt?
Hmm? Your feet hurt?
Yeah. It hurt after the first couple of days.
After the first couple of days, but then you kind of got into it, right?
I started to really get sore.
Yeah. Did you wear special shoes?
Well, you just wear tennis shoes.
Regular tennis shoes.
You got a pair of running shoes?
Connor's special pair.
Yeah, oh. I got toe shoes.
Toe shoes?
Oh. They're pretty amazing. Tell them all about it.
What's
a
toe shoe?
They're really hard to put on, but I have blue ones. And
oh, these are the ones with all five toes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I've heard about them. Well, actually, my wife tried on a pair down at REI in Seattle. Looked
pretty
strange.
Do you find that they're a lot easier to run with?
For the first few months, your calves start to hurt, yes. But after that, you're fine.
Yeah. Now, Connor is kind of a little bit of a special student as well. Not only did he run the marathon club, but he did a 5K, and he was invited to Washington, D.C. for Special Olympics.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that,
yeah.
Connor?
What event do you do?
I'm doing 1.8 miles, and it's in Myrtle Beach in South Carolina. And then we're going to drive down to the White House and...
Oh, yeah.
Hopefully get to meet the president.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Well,
that's very exciting to see some of the kids move on and join, you know, running clubs and other types of clubs in town, which has been fabulous.
Yeah. So do you think any of you would ever really run a marathon in one go?
I would.
You're going to do it?
Yeah.
I would try it.
Yeah.
I would try it.
I heard somebody said that if you run a marathon, that the health effects last for a long time, that it's like, you know, you still have some effect on your body like 50, 60 years after you run a marathon.
Which is why we want to get them started. Mm-hmm. So
Yeah. Mm-hmm. 26 miles, 385 yards. Anybody know why it's that long?
No.
Well...
I have a wonderful story to share with you later.
Yeah, that now you've got to you got to take them to marathon and show them why.
And I did share it with everyone, but everybody was out in the hallway, so only certain people were able to hear.
Okay,
the story.
Well, you'll have to bring them up on why it's 26 miles, 385 yards, because that's something you really need to know if you're going to do this sort of thing. Wow. Well, I salute you. People who run marathons are a breed apart. I really believe that. I think if you've done it, then there's a little something inside you that says that you can do something that other people sometimes just either won't or can't do. And I'm proud of you. I really am. Thank you so much for coming down and telling us about this.
Well, thank you for having
us. Wow. Yeah.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 8th of November, 2011. It was on this day, 1894, Robert Frost published his first poem. It was published in a newspaper called The Independent, and it was a poem called My Butterfly. He graduated at the top of his class in Lawrence, Massachusetts, small high school, and won a scholarship to Dartmouth. His co-valedictorian was his high school sweetheart, Eleanor White, who was going on to St. Lawrence University. Robert Frost did not do well at Dartmouth. He left in November, and he went back home to Lawrence to help out his mother, a school teacher who was struggling to keep her students under control. Frost arrived on the scene, and he performed some corporal punishment, got the classroom back in order, also worked at a sawmill and at a farm. And he worried that his sweetheart, Eleanor, was losing interest in him. She was enjoying her college years. She made a lot of friends. She was spending time with other young men. And Robert Frost wrote her a despairing poem, which began, "The day will come when you will cease to know, the heart will cease to tell you, sadder yet, though you say o'er and o'er, once you knew, you will forget, you will forget." He wanted to marry her right away, but she insisted on waiting until she'd finished college. She wanted him to become a poet and make something of himself and get something published. So he did, My Butterfly, and he had the poem and four others made into a little book on handmade paper bound in leather, made two copies and showed up at St. Lawrence University to deliver one to Eleanor. but she was not glad to see him, and she sent him away. He thought she was ending their engagement. He was sure she was in love with someone else. He took a train down to Virginia, to Norfolk, and from there he walked 10 miles into the heart of the dismal swamp, not caring whether he lived or died, but ran into a group of duck hunters. They gave him a lift back to civilization. By the time he made it back to Lawrence, My Butterfly had been published. It cheered him up. He continued to write. A year later, in December 1895, Robert Frost and Eleanor White were married. And later he wrote, I have been one acquainted with the night. I have walked out in rain, and back in rain. I have outwalked the furthest city light. Here's a poem for today by Aaron Kramer, entitled Dogs. Looking foolish next to the tree, in a 1 o'clock rain, umbrella aloft, the leash in my other hand. I wanted my late-coming neighbor to understand that dogs are worth the expense, inconvenience, and pain. Their tails are truthful, no coiled rebellion beneath a loving look. They're quick to kiss you and quick to fetch for you. And, should you raise a stick threateningly, they are quick to show their teeth. And better still, but this I never revealed, when you bring downfall home, the death of a hope, their nonchalant manner does more for you than a drink. And best of all, when triumphs to be unsealed, such lack of respect they show for the envelope. Your fingers halt, the brain cools, and you think. A poem by Aaron Kramer, Dogs, from Wicked Times, published by University of Illinois Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. And by CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight, nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. Produced by our technical director, Thomas Schweitzer. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
In celebration of Geography Awareness Week, which is November 13th through the 19th, Juno will be hosting its first GeoFest. This is a free, fun, and educational family event. It'll be held on Saturday, November 12th. It runs from 1 to 4 in the afternoon at the Mendenhall Glacier Visitor Center. Now, Geography Awareness Week is an annual celebration. It was enacted by Congress in 1987. It invites families and schools to engage in fun, educational experiences that draw attention to geoliteracy and the importance of geography education. GeoFest events reflect the theme Geography, the Adventure in Your Community, and it stresses participation from local organizations. Here in Juneau, the Alaska Coastal Rainforest Center, the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, Discovery Southeast, National Park Service, Thunder Mountain High School, USDA Forest Service, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the University of Alaska Southeast all partake in these activities. There are hands-on activities and contests that occur at GeoFests, and there are prizes. The event is sponsored by the UA Geography Program. It's based at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, along with the Geography Department at the University of Alaska Southeast. It's funded in part by the National Geographic Society Education Foundation. Governor Sean Parnell has issued a proclamation that declares November 13th to the 19th Geography Awareness Week throughout Alaska. The proclamation will be on display. For more information about GeoFest, you can contact Katie Kennedy. She's at cmkennedy@alaska.edu or 907-474-6121. If you'd like more information about Geography Awareness Week, you can visit www.geographyawareness, all one big long word, geographyawarenessweek.org. The telephone number at KUAC, or at KTOO, is 586-3636, and we're in the middle of a pledge drive. We have people standing by in our Studio K, and they are from the state Friends of the Alaska State Museum, and they're also from Plain Rain, an artists group here in Juneau. And if you would like to call in, you could pledge to be part of the fund drive at KTOO. Now, Amy Houck did that, and we thank her very much for her contribution to KTOO's ongoing fund drive. Thank you very much, Amy.
These are places in the world. Some you know, some you don't. Some you'll visit, and some you won't. Some are near, and some are far. Some sound exotic like Zanzibar. 'Cause these are places in the world. Bombay, Cape May, Mandalay, Baffin Bay, Baghdad, Leningrad, Ashgabat, Trinidad, L.A., Norway, Paraguay, Monterey, Singapore, Ecuador, Bangalore, Baltimore. These are places in the world. Fiji, Sicily, Nagasaki, Tennessee, Cairo, Quito, Borneo, Idaho, Taiwan, Dijon, Saigon, Tehran, Guatemala, Oklahoma, Argentina, North Dakota. These are places in the world. Some are new and some are old. Some are hot and some are cold. Some are low and some are high. Some are wet and some are dry. 'Cause these are places in the world.
I am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
I am a leader.
Volunteer.
I give back to my community.
Culture, science, business, faith. I
am scared of you.
I am scared of you.
Here is my story.
Here are our stories.
You're hearing what it sounds like when Lego robots are hard at work, running a course guided by the middle school-aged members of Skagway's winning first Lego League robotics team.
I'm Rosalie Westfall, and I'm 13.
I'm Kiara Selmer, and I am 12.
I'm Trevor Cox, and I'm 13.
I'm Jen Ravens, and I'm 12.
I'm Riley Westfall, and I'm 16.
First Lego League, or FLL, competitions are all about the robots, but they're also all about problem-solving and teamwork. The Skagway team had to win at the state competition in order to qualify for the World Festival, held in St. Louis, Missouri this spring. Each year, students problem solve around a theme that applies to the real world. The Skagway team created what they called the Wheeze Be Gone, a special mask that would help people with asthma when they're active outside in the Alaska cold.
We tested our mask, so I went outside in negative 8-degree weather and tested it, and it kept my face warm without becoming soggy.
Rosalie Westfeld says FLL is fun because she gets to make good friends, meet new people, and learn a lot.
This year I got to learn a lot about asthma because I, even though I have it, I didn't really know that much about it. People, they love basketball, but I don't like basketball, so this is something that I can do to my after school activity. It's a sport for the mind. This is like our basketball.
The Skagway team is already working on ideas for next year's challenge. I'm Shanna Sheehy.
I am a teenager.
I am an Alaskan.
I give back.
Do you see me?
Recognize youth ages 12 to 19 at spiritofyouth.org.
Provided by the Association of Alaska School Boards.
Tomorrow on Juneau Afternoon, Jeff will be talking with Alaska author Tricia Brown. She's in town for a talk and a book signing at the downtown library tomorrow night at 5. We'll find out about Juneau Lyric Opera's upcoming production of La Boheme. We'll get a preview of the week's fall forum on the politics of global climate change with keynote speaker Dr. Detlef Prince. And we'll go to the movies with Vehicles as a Theme with Clint Farr and Pat Race. That'll be on Juneau Afternoon tomorrow. This is KTOO Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau. and on Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Auk Bay, we're on K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, it's K269 AO. We're at 101.7 there. Gustavus listens on K201 AM at 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. And in Excursion Inlet, Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9.